Hey friends, you've heard me talk about Blind Tiger Record Club, and that's because they're awesome. They send curated vinyl every month straight to your door in the genre that you choose. They've got new, sealed, full-length 12-inch records from artists of today. They've got double albums, 180-gram, color variant, hard-to-find imports, just super cool stuff. I'm a member of the record club, and I look forward every month to getting that box. Really cool music, and as well as like hats and t-shirts. They've even got their own record players. They're so cool. It's a great way to beef up your vinyl collection with great new records that are coming out now. And you don't have to worry about it. They just show up in the genre that you choose. Super awesome. So check them out. Blind Tiger Record Club. Your vinyl, your choice. From Nashville, Tennessee, this is The Pivot. Stories of people who've made a change. Welcome to The Pivot. My name is Andrew Osinga. My guest today is Todd Dixon. Todd is the CEO and founder of Valor Collegiate Academies. Right now, that's two middle schools in Nashville. It'll be a high school next year. Todd comes from California, where he was a part of really successful charter schools there. And then he's had a couple other careers before that. And so I'm excited for you to hear his story arc, which is fascinating in its own right. It's also interesting to talk to Todd because he spends so much time with kids in a very pivotal age. That middle school age is where so much of who we are, I think, starts to become really fully formed in our sense of, am I good at this? Am I good at that? Did these people accept me? Can I spend time with these people? And the way that he has built the culture of this school to enable conversation and really listening to each other and even diversity and diversity of thought and experience is really, really cool. Our oldest daughter attends one of these schools, and we have watched how she has grown in not just knowing stuff, like a seventh grader should know stuff, but in the way that she thinks and thinks about others and thinks about how her experience is different from their experience and how that changes the conversation. And that's not a thing that I think a lot of seventh graders typically think about, but it's something that is foundational to being able to interact with people throughout our lives. And the school is very intentional at making that happen. And I think that's just fantastic. And it was really fun to get to talk to Todd about why and how they build that into a kid's education. But before we get to that interview, I want to give you a quick update on me. My album, The Painted Desert, has been out now on Kickstarter for about 5 days, depending on when you're listening to this. I'm at this exact moment on Monday, the 22nd. We are at like 78% funded on Kickstarter, which is great, but the record's already done, so if you support the record, you can download it immediately, and that's been really, really fun, and people's response to the album has just been exceptional. I've been so pleased and encouraged by hearing that feedback. Stay tuned after this episode of The Pivot for another little bonus podcast where I talk about another song from The Painted Desert. Also, some other cool news for just me personally and for this podcast is that this weekend I moved into a new space over at the Art House here in Nashville. So this was Charlie Peacock's old home and studio. He bought an old church and I think the early 90s, an abandoned little country church, and turned it into a recording studio and meeting space, as well as his family's home. And now another family lives here and runs it, and I have a really cool space in here where I can write songs and produce records and do interviews and meet with young artists and all the things that I love to do. So I'm really excited about that. So it's nice to finally have kind of a home base to work out of again after last year of kind of bouncing around. So that's the update. Go check out my record on Kickstarter, but not before you enjoy this conversation with Todd Dixon. The Pivot is also brought to you by New College Franklin. New College Franklin is a four-year Christian liberal arts college in Franklin, Tennessee, dedicated to excellent academics and a rich community. they offer a unique opportunity to become part of that learning community that's focused on educating the whole person. For more, go to newcollegefranklin.org. I first met you at somebody's house, some random person's house, I don't know who, when you were kind of going around the community just meeting people and talking about Valor, probably before you were even open, because you did that for a while, right?
Yeah, I got people's here, homes and... we moved in 2012, so 5 years ago.
Okay.
And then the first 2 years were pre-opening, so we opened in 2014, so the first year, a ton of that year was just coffees and like wine and cheese things at people's houses and community centers and, you know, just tons of meeting with potential parents, but also meeting with potential funders, potential, you know, I was trying to figure out who to join my board and who would be good just to have as connections in the city. So I think I tracked, I had this crazy map where I was tracking all these different people and then how they were connected to each other. And there was
like a sort of serial killer
map. Yeah, it was like a serial killer map. And I think I had over 1,000 coffees or meetings in the first year. So I met with like 3 people a day almost for a year. So I met with like an unbelievable amount of people in the first year. So, which is, I'm an introvert actually by nature, so it was actually like a tremendous willpower thing.
I can't imagine an extrovert wanting to have 1,000 coffees in a year.
Yeah, so it was really awesome though. Actually, I learned like so much about Nashville and what people wanted and, you know, like all the histories. So in terms of like coming to a city and then like propelling yourself really quickly into like everything that's happening and the needs, it helped me design a much better school for like what Nashville needed instead of just maybe what I thought I wanted to do. And so it was really helpful.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Because I mean, you were in Southern California.
Northern California.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, we were up in the Bay Area in San Francisco.
Gotcha. Okay. I never know where that line is between Northern and Southern.
Yeah, everyone there knows. They're very clear.
I always learn that when I say it wrong. So you moved from Northern California to the South. Well, I mean, that was probably, I imagine, a pretty big cultural shift outside of just, uprooting a family and starting over. I guess it's probably a good way to meet people is to have 1,000 coffees and probably make some friends over the course of that time. But what was it like to move across the country and start a school in the buckle of the Bible Belt?
Yeah, it was definitely a shift, you know, coming from, you know, San Francisco might be the bluest dot of, you know, of dots in the United States.
And Boston, yeah.
Yeah, Boston, like there's a few very blue dots, but it's one of them. And so coming to the South, my wife and I were prepared that would be a shift in a lot of different ways. But we were a little concerned about it because like just some of like the, it's more like the red when you get outside of Nashville, and some of the pieces of that were concerning in some ways. You know, in other ways, I think being in a bubble that's any color, like too dark of a color, I think isn't necessarily a good thing either. You know? So in some ways, I was actually looking forward to that. And I grew up in Colorado, which is every year it's kind of a swing state, and there's just a lot of mix. I mean, we're just talking politics, but like red and blue, you know, using that term, but there's just more of a mix of people with different backgrounds, which I think is healthy. And for the type of schools that I'm passionate about, that's actually good. And that's actually something that we want is to have families with differing perspectives come together and really learn how to reach across lines of difference and understand each other. So I was personally excited about that piece of coming to the South because there just would be a better opportunity for more people with different backgrounds to come together. But there was a lot of whispers to me before I decided if we were going to move or not, and not so much whispers that people weren't sure if we could do the type of school that we wanted to do in the South. They felt like it might be too broad of a set of diverse backgrounds, and especially the racial line they thought might be harder in the South. And so there were, you know, for trying to do a diverse by design school, there were some people that weren't so sure you could pull it off in the South. But that was one of the drivers for me that was exciting to me.
Yeah.
I was like, I think we can do that.
And, oh, yeah. Well, I want to get more into that as we go. I guess let's start. I remember when you were talking about, I was at some, you know, this wine and cheese thing, somebody's house. And you were talking about how you had started your career in real estate, right? So where was that, in Colorado?
Yeah, I had looking back now, I was kind of a serial entrepreneur. But I actually got a master's in electrical engineering. Yeah, and I went and did my undergrad in electrical engineering and then got a master's in electrical engineering and then promptly started a real estate company after that. And it was actually just one of my very close friends from high school who I was living with right after graduated grad school and had my first real job as an engineer, actually. And we were living together, and he had dropped out of college and actually had started his own real estate company, and he was making like $300,000 a year, and I was making like $40,000 a year in my engineering job and wasn't really that happy doing it. And so we dreamed up this idea of like a cool real estate company that actually, like, we would do high volume and split the real estate deal into pieces so that you'd have teams of people that would do a real estate deal instead of like the classic realtor that did it. And so we took that idea and built around that, and it was actually very successful. And so we built a pretty good real estate business together in my 20s. And then I had like an early midlife crisis that I was not doing what I felt like was my purpose or what was meaningful to me. And that's when I ended up shifting into education.
So tell me about that. What led to your leaving a successful career and starting over?
I was in real estate for about 6 years. So I was nearing my 30s. I was 28, 29. I have an identical twin brother that I'm really close with. And he had gone back to school at that point to become a therapist. And he and I were in regular contact. And he was just saying what a shift it had caused in him in terms of finding something that he truly loved doing. And so that was kind of the start for me of the unraveling, the start of the early midlife crisis, because we're so close and I could just see, like,
he's
like,
happy.
Man, he's aligned
like
and
happy.
I would like to be happy too. And so he actually went to India for 6 months and he was writing his master's thesis. He got his master's in therapy. And so I had made enough money in real estate that year that I decided to take the second 6 months off of the year. And I went and I decided to go to India with him. So I went, he was already there, and I went to meet him. And so I spent about 2.5 months in India with him, and we did some amazing treks up into the Himalayas. And I went kind of with this purpose of thinking, like, I want to like take a step back and figure out what I really want to do with my life. I'm about to turn 30 and my brother's already happy. I want to be happy.
Where so, in India were you?
We were mostly in the north. I met him in the south in Madras, but then we went up into the Himalayas and Rishikesh was kind of our home base there.
Gotcha.
And then we did some treks up into the mountains.
Oh, that's awesome. I spent a month or two there.
Oh, wow.
10 years ago in Lucknow and Agra. It was awesome.
Yeah, I mean, it was, looking back now, because that is kind of where I decided to take a big pivot in my life, it was, you know, one of the most important trips of my life.
Yeah, well, there's something pretty amazing about creating space, I think, to just go, okay, I'm putting this other thing to bed. Now, I mean, I imagine you at that point can't just jump right back into your real estate business, or could you? I mean, was it just sort of on pause, or did you step away?
I had had enough people working with me or for me at that point that I just put it on pause.
Okay.
It was still happening while I was gone.
So you did have that, there was that kind of safety net of something you could go back to, but it is nice to get that clarity. And
yeah, so it was, yeah, it was really powerful, and I spent a lot of time, we did a lot of meditation, and that was the first time I'd ever really kind of gone deep on that, and just having that space, that quiet space, It was also a time I was really trying to figure out where I really stood spiritually.
Yeah.
Because we grew up in a Christian household, but then I was also interested in Buddhism and understanding kind of what that looked like, and then read a lot of books around kind of the perennial philosophy of like many different paths up the same mountain and kind of how you translate a lot of the language in different religions and try to see where the core similarities were. So that was really an interesting, helpful time for me around kind of my spirituality and like what made sense to me. But I remember I was actually on a bus ride. It was like a 16-hour bus ride from New Delhi up to Rishikesh. And
those buses are
they're
terrifying.
Intense. Yeah.
They wait. It's like they wait until the very last possible second.
Yeah, there's like people hanging off the sides, and there's like, it was actually a pilgrimage because Rishikesh is at the base of the Ganges River, which is it's the holiest river in India. And I think every 6 years there's a massive pilgrimage to the source of the Ganges River, and so we were there at that time, so there was like millions literally of pilgrims coming up the streets walking. It was really cool.
That's
it was really
an amazing
powerful
experience.
Spiritual experience. Yeah, it was just amazing. And they go cleanse themselves in the river there, and so it was really amazing. But I can remember Darren was asleep and I was on the bus and it was like bouncing up and down. I hadn't slept in like like 2 days. But we just went by this little school. And I looked out the window and there's all these kids like playing out in the middle of the school, and it just like hit me like right. It's just like a very memorable moment where I was like, I actually want to be a teacher. That's what I want to do. And so when Darren woke up, I was like, you know what? I'm going to be a teacher. That's what I want to do. And it was a very clear moment, like a crystal clear moment that that's right. I like felt very clear that that's what I wanted to do. And then I came back and just put everything in motion to make that happen.
Had you ever had the idea of being a teacher before?
Not really. So it was like a moment that I had started volunteering with a kid that I really loved who was at a residential treatment center close to my house in Colorado that I had become really attached to over the last year leading up to that. And I used to visit him like once every 2 weeks, and then I started to visit him once a week, and then I started visiting him like 3 times a week. I would go just hang out with him, play basketball, go get ice cream. It was like a big brother setup. And so I did recognize like how much I loved working specifically with lower income kids or kids that just didn't have as many opportunities as I had had growing up.
Yeah.
And that was really like I really enjoyed that process, and that was the favorite part of my life at that point, much more than real estate.
Yeah.
And so that was, I think, looking back, that was the driver. So, because it was really like, I want to be a teacher to help kids that don't have as many opportunities in life.
So when you got back from India, what did it look like to put that into motion, moving into education?
Yeah, actually, so I got back. I'd actually just started dating my now wife right before I went to India. We started dating like a month before I went, and then I said, hey, I'm going to India. And so I got back, and I was making quite a bit of money at the time when I met her, so I was, I had taken her on some pretty nice dates, and then when I got back, first I had this giant beard because I'd been in India, and I went to see her, and like I was like really skinny because I hadn't been eating, I had a big beard. And then I was like, I'm actually going to sell my company and become a teacher.
That's exactly what she thought was going to happen.
Yeah. It's, to her credit, she was like super excited about it. Could tell that I was really excited. And so we like picked up right where we left off dating wise. And then, but then I decided if I'm going to sell, I want to go to great education school. So I spent a lot of time researching them, and I decided I want to go to Stanford. I felt like they had the best school. And so then I told my then girlfriend that I was going to move to San Francisco. I was going to sell the real estate and the house. I got back in like September, and I said I want to be there by January. And so she said that sounds amazing. And so then I said, well, you should come with me. And she said yes. And then I said, well, if you're going to come with me, we should just get married. And so we eloped. Actually, so we eloped like in December, right before we moved. So it was like a major, change.
That's a great story.
Yeah. So we eloped. I sold the house, sold the real estate company, and moved with really nothing, essentially, out to San Francisco. So we just drove out there. And then I worked in a residential treatment center for 6 months and applied to Stanford and then got in and then started there in June of that year. But I worked for about 6 months in a residential treatment center and totally loved it. Like, rode my bike every day there and made no money, like $10 an hour or something. But I totally loved it. So.
That's great. What kind of residential treatment center? Like adults, kids?
It was for kids, okay. Yeah. So it was called the Burt Center, and it was actually right where the Flying Lady houses are, like that iconic. It's like the house just to the left if you look at the picture.
No way. Yeah,
which is, so it's a gorgeous area. And this old woman had donated her house to become a residential treatment center. So it's like a beautiful old house it was really small, had like 20 kids. And my brother, Darren, my twin brother, was actually out there working as a therapist and had worked at this center before. So he's the one who set me up with the job.
That's great.
But yeah, you just worked intimately with 8 to 10 kids, and I didn't have any training, so I was like one of the ones who was just on the ground, like basically kind of babysitting and just supporting them, playing with them a lot. So it was a very joyful but tiring 12-hour shift.
That's great. So then you went to school, and did you then go get a job as a teacher? At what point did you start a school?
Yeah, so I went through the program there and then met some people there that were really passionate about thinking about different ways of doing schools as well. But part of my promise with Heather, my wife, when I kind of made the abrupt shift to education, as she said, like, I'd really love to go live in another country somewhere before we settle in into like a teaching life somewhere. And so we decided that when I graduated Stanford, we looked around at places around the country, or around the world actually, to go work as teachers. And so we got a job at an international school in Portugal. So right when I finished Stanford, we moved to Portugal, and I taught high school. It was my very first year of teaching, but it was at a private international baccalaureate school. So I taught high school physics there, and she taught kindergarten. So, and we lived there for 2 years, and then we actually stayed a third year and that's where I started my teaching career. But during that time, my friends that were at Stanford, we were in regular communication, and they were thinking up the idea for a school, and actually got it started and off the ground in the last year that I was in Portugal. And so I was really excited. I almost wanted to go back that year, but we stayed another year, and then I came back the second year, and it was called Summit Prep. So I came back and was a teacher there in its second year of existence.
Okay, and that was a charter school?
It was a charter school.
And can you tell us exactly what a charter school is and why that route of education is interesting to you?
Yeah, charter schools are really, they're very interesting. They can be really controversial for lots of complex reasons.
Yeah, we learned that education. When we sent our kids here. We had no idea. Yeah. We were picking fights with people.
Yeah, it's an amazingly complex. It's kind of like healthcare and public education are both just so complex. There's just a lot of nuance to it. But for the basics kind of a charter school is it's still a public school. It gets public funding just like any other school. But it has a slightly different governance structure. And so it has its own board of governors, like a elected board. And then generally you have control over your curriculum, and you have control over your talent, so your hiring and firing. And you have control over your budget. So all of those things are pushed down to the school level. And the idea would be that gives those schools more chance to be innovative and to try things that are a little bit different than the larger, more bureaucratic public system. And so the theory is that you should have some charter schools and systems so that you can get more innovation within those schools. And they also can be a healthy form of competition with other schools because it's somewhat of a monopoly in the public system. And so, and that lots of people agree and disagree with that, but that's a fairly basic explanation of it. And we the school that we were thinking of for Summit had a whole different idea of like how to spend the time was spent, and it was mostly around the idea of how could we create a school that would be really awesome for teachers. And we shopped that to multiple different districts around the Bay Area, and they all didn't want it. They all turned it down. They thought it was too innovative. And so, because Stanford actually doesn't like charter schools in general. So like the schooling that I was getting was somewhat anti-charter. And so we weren't big
charter. But you were all Stanford guys that, that started Summit.
Yeah, but we were, we definitely weren't idealistic about or had an ideological like preference for charter schools. We actually probably were the opposite. But we then ended up thinking this is the only way we'll get this school open is if we do it as a charter school, because none of the districts will open it. And so we kind of backed into the charter world a little bit more than some, which is just an interesting take. But but we opened that school. I caught a lot of crap for coming in late and like missing the first 2 years, which are always the hardest to get schools open. And so I came in the second year. But then I ended up teaching.
Wisdom,
looking back now, I'm like, I should have done that at Valor too. That would have saved me a lot of gray hairs.
Let somebody else go do 1,001 and cheese events.
Exactly. So we opened that and it was tons of work and tons of fun.
That was a high school, right?
It was high school, 9 through 12. So, and that went well. And the principal of that school, I was a teacher there, as a physics teacher, and then I took over for the principal, and she became the CEO, and we opened a second school. And then I stayed as principal for a long time at the founding school. And then we opened 2 schools, and then 4 schools, and 6 schools, and now there's 14 schools as part of that network.
Yeah, and I mean, they were pretty revolutionary, both in how they were educating kids, and also they did really, really well, right?
Yeah, we did some really innovative, interesting things, and we had really good performance. I mean, we were ranked one of the top 10 schools in the country by Newsweek magazine, we just got really high performance and we were diverse by design, so we were really passionate about having a mix of about half our kids are middle income or above and half are lower income, and that's been a passion of mine for the last 20 years in my new world of education, was just really believing that that would be the best thing for all of the kids in the school, but also be the smartest long-term game that we could play for the best public education system in the country, is that if we had kids from different backgrounds, especially socioeconomic range, going to public schools together, that would be the best thing for the country in the long run. So it's just something I've been passionate about for a long time.
Yeah, that's really cool. So did you leave that role to come here in Nashville? How did that happen?
Yeah, so I had been there for about 7 years, and I was just about to turn 40, and I was thinking, you know, if I want to do my own set of schools, which I had been thinking about for a while, it's probably now is about the time to do it. And so I told Diane and our Summit team that I was going to do that, but I really wanted to have a smooth transition. So I gave him like a 2-year notice that I was like, in 2 years, I'm going to do this. So I wanted to groom someone, you know, for my spot and make sure I made a good choice on kind of how we did that. So, so then I started thinking about where I was going to do this. And, a interesting story during that time is that my brother, Darren, was doing all this awesome therapeutic work, and he had worked at this company called Seneca Center in the Bay Area, which works with some of the most challenged kids in California. So the kids that didn't stay in the juvenile detention centers and couldn't stay in the traditional residential treatment homes even. Mm-hmm. So they would go to Seneca Center. So they had some severe trauma and some severe backgrounds that were really challenging. And he developed a really amazing social emotional learning program to help them develop the skills that they needed to be productive, kind citizens. And I went to visit him once while I was the principal at Summit, and we had just gotten like all these awards about being like supposedly one of the best schools in the country, and our kids are like doing well in AP exams. And but then I went to watch a group of high school kids that he had, and they were in a circle, in a process he called Circle. and I sat in the circle with them. We actually tricked the kid, so I actually went and sat in the circle and with his clothes on, and they thought I was him, and they were all sitting in the circle, and it's a pretty serious process, this circle process. And so they were sitting there, and he had told me like how to get the circle started. And then the door opened, and then he walked in, and like all these kids, like heads blew up because they didn't know he had a twin brother, and it was quite humorous. But once they got into their circle process, my head blew up because I actually was I was deeply moved by what these kids were able to do in terms of like expressing their emotions and connecting with each other in a really authentic, genuine way. That caused me to think like we have to bring that stuff into public schools. Like that's beyond what I can do as an adult, and it's certainly beyond what our kids can do at Summit right now. And so, so Darren and I started talking about that. This was multiple years in advance of but we had already started thinking about we should probably bring those worlds together into a school.
Wow.
And so, as we were thinking about kind of that piece, that's when I started to think about leaving Summit, and I was going to either stay in California and build a new organization there, go home to Denver, where I grew up. And then Mayor Carl Dean, who was the mayor at the time of Nashville, flew out to Summit to visit it. And I was actually, just happened to be in the building, and he came unannounced, like they didn't schedule a visit. And so like the front desk was like, can anyone tour the mayor of Nashville? He's here. And I was like, I can do it. I don't. And so it was just like somewhat a random, depending on how you view that and your background, it was either random or it was Providence in some way or something. But I toured him, and then he recruited me after that. I said, I'm thinking about leaving to start my own organization. And that's how it all happened. Then they started to put like a heavy recruiting pitch for us to come do it in Nashville.
So, and then you and Darren came together, right?
Well, I came first, yeah. And so my wife and they brought us out. I first sent the email to my wife from the mayor and said, what do you think about Nashville? And she replied, no. It was like that was it, the whole email. No. And she just loved it.
There's a lot of wiggle room there.
Yeah. It was like an emphatic no. Because she just loved where we were in the Bay Area and like was really happy, and we had two little kids at that time, we were enjoying ourselves, and but then we came out and visited, and she loved it, we both loved it, and just thought it was a great town, and it was way more affordable than the Bay Area, and we thought we could actually get a normal size house and have this was 5 years ago, it's definitely got more expensive,
almost the same now.
So it was, we ended up just thinking this would be a great place to raise our family. And it was also, for a lot of reasons, we thought it would be a good place to start a school. And I was, as I mentioned, I was like really interested to see if we could do a really diverse school in the South, because I thought that would be a great, important contribution to the education system.
Yeah, I would agree. So you end up, they offer you, they recruit you, say, come on to Nashville. So you give them 2 years at Summit, and then you get here, and what does it look like? The schools aren't open for a couple of years. Do you immediately go into the wine and cheese mode, or like, what is it like to move to a new city and decide you're going to start a network of schools?
Yeah.
That sounds like a thing that you can't do.
Yeah, it was kind of crazy. It was intimidating too, but I actually can vividly remember that we got here. It was the summer of 2012, and like the day we got here was 107 degrees when our moving truck pulled up, and it was super humid. And my wife was like, tears were like coming down her face. And then it set a record. It was like a 30 or 40 year record, but it was over 100 degrees for 14 straight days or something.
That.
So like our first 2 weeks of living here was like miserably hot.
That's the worst.
And the group that recruited me here too we got here like right over 4th of July, and so they were all on vacation. And so I just remember like going to work the first week, like dripping with sweat, and I was wearing a tie because I didn't know what else to do. So I was like, maybe I should probably look nice even though there's no one there. But I just remember sitting in this big empty office and there was no one there, and just sitting at my desk being like, how does one start a charter network by yourself?
Where did you go to work? Like, where were you even, what was that office?
They had an office down at Cummings Station on Demumbrian downtown, and it was called the Charter Incubator. So there was an organization that was helping to incubate me. So they had a nice office down there. So I had a little desk in an office space, but they were all gone for the first 2 weeks. So, but I do have this vivid memory of being like, especially because I'd been so busy and so structured for so long at Summit. It's just that type of work in education is very, there's just a lot. There's more than you can ever get done. And so you feel extremely busy all the time. And so to then just sit and be like, I'm not sure what I should do first. And there isn't like a map that tells you how to do something like that. And so, but the first thing I did is call the mayor actually and a couple other people that he's connected with, and they met with me and helped me build this long, long list of all these people that I should meet. And then there's a couple of them that were pretty very well connected around the city. And so I would send them an email and say, I'm ready for my first week. And then they would send out like 20 emails, intro emails, to different people. And then I would set up meetings with all of them. And then I'd say, I'm about done with that. Let's go to the next 20. And then they would send intro emails to the next 20. And so I just like grinded through all these, and I was just revising my pitch kind of what I wanted to do, but also listening to what people wanted and then kind of combining what I like my pitch with what people wanted. And looking back, it was super helpful to get me into being able to understand both of those things, what I wanted and what other people wanted, and trying to meld those. But it also helped me get good at just selling or talking about my vision.
How much would you say the final product of the vision, what percentage of that was what you came to Nashville with? Like, did it radically change, or was it pretty much the same?
It changed quite a bit. You know, I'd say over half of it probably was in response to kind of getting an understanding of what people wanted and where we were. Maybe not half, but probably, you know, 40% was stuff that was I felt like a little more community specific and responsive to what I was learning from, you know, either what I felt like people were saying about what the community needed or more practical things about what could be afforded here and other things. So I think, I learned a lot in that first year. One of the funnier stories was I had already decided I really wanted to call it True North Public Schools, because like finding your true north and having your North Star to guide you or just things I really liked. But I think it was like my second or third, more of those wine and cheese events, like a really nice woman, like in a nice Southern accent, like said to me, she's like, child, you cannot call it True North here in the South.
You know, when you say it like that, I see what you're talking about.
Yeah, and I was like, I hadn't really thought of that. So, so we decided that might not be the best name. So we
Yankee High School.
Exactly.
It's amazing. So you ended up starting a middle school and not a high school. Why?
Yeah, we were just getting ready to start middle schools at Summit when I was leaving. And our high school teachers had been begging us to open middle schools from day one, because with our diverse background of kids, especially kids that just didn't get good opportunities in elementary and middle school, and they weren't at high quality schools, they would come in so far behind in ninth grade that trying to get them to a college bar or getting them ready, you know, to really be successful in the world was extremely difficult when you got them in ninth grade. So I already knew I wanted to go back farther in Nashville to kind of the transition age is fifth grade. So like fifth through eighth made sense is to start with that. But I was also nervous about that because it wasn't my expertise as middle schoolers.
There's a special like medal of bravery at the end of your life for being working with middle school students for a long amount of time. So you guys started one school and now you've got two and you're about to start a high school. So what's the vision, sort of how is it coalescing as it's become a real thing?
Yeah, it's been a great joy to do it. Like, it's really been the joy of my life of my career, I should say. You know, I have three kids that are the real joy of my life. But it's just been really, really fun to do it. And it's been really hard. It's definitely the hardest thing I've ever done to get it off the ground. And but it's also been deeply rewarding to seeing like all of the kids and just watching their growth has been great. And the vision has been, you know, pretty, we've been pretty good about sticking to our vision. You know, we had a pretty clear vision of doing these three schools, and we've been pretty disciplined and good about just executing on the next step. You know, we've been responsive to feedback, and there's pieces of the model that certainly aren't exactly what I thought they would be at this time. But it's been a fun ride for sure to do that. And so we open the high school next year, so I'm kind of back into my comfort zone, which I'm like really looking forward to, is to get to go back to the high school kids too.
That's great. So, and you got, I mean, I follow the Twitter and I read the email, you know, I know that Valor has won a lot of awards and they've consistently sort of in the top percentages of different performances. I'm curious what some of those great stats are and which of those are the most important to you.
Yeah. So we've done really well academically. So if you just look at this, that slice of describing a great school, which is a very important slice in my opinion, but it's not the entire description of a great school. Mm-hmm. But if you just look at academic performance, we've done exceptionally well. And you could actually probably make some pretty strong arguments. Like the two schools are as good as any schools in the state in terms of academics. And the one thing I like about Tennessee, which we didn't have in California and they don't have in many places around the country, is they have a really sophisticated growth measurement. So they measure how much kids achieve. So there's an achievement measurement which would say like 75% of your kids passed fifth grade math. And so there's that just shows you like what percentage of your kids are on track. And that's achievement. But that's tilted a little bit unfairly to like a Williamson County or an affluent area where kids got lots of support at home and they went to a good elementary school. So by the time they get to middle school, 85% of them might be, you know, passing math. But the teachers may or may not, they could have basically just taken a kid that was going to pass and done an average job with them and they'd still got an 85%. But they also have a growth measure here, so they actually have a pretty sophisticated way to look at when a kid comes in at the start of the year, how much you expect them to grow. And then they look at how much they grow, and then they give you points as a school for if you grew them more than expected or less than expected or just the same amount as expected. And so... that's really interesting. So you can actually look at schools both on achievement and on growth, and that's where Valor's done exceptionally well. Is that we've achieved in the top 1% of schools in the state. So our achievement is really high, but we've also shown growth in the top 1% in the state. And we're the only schools in the whole state that can do both of those things. Is that we're that high in the top. And this year, there's a new state test. So we're in the top 3% for achievement and top 1% for growth. But there's no other middle schools that do that in the state. There's two other ones that are very close, but they're magnet schools. And so they're academic magnets. So they only take kids that are in the top 25%.
Wow. And you mentioned that this phrase a couple times, diversity by design. So I love that. That's really thoughtful. And this school is super diverse. Can you tell me a bit about, like, what's the breakdown and how do you do that? There are a bunch of Kurdish folks, there are a bunch of Hispanic folks and white and black. I mean, you've got all kind of, everybody's here, which you don't see in a lot of public schools, especially in a highly segregated area like Nashville.
Yeah, so... that is one of our core anchors, or one of the things that I care most about is having a school that's truly diverse and really helping kids to be prepared to thrive in a diverse world, which is, you know, the United States is becoming more and more diverse, and which I think is amazing and beautiful and should actually be a strength of our country. But unfortunately, because of segregation and even our education system hasn't educated everyone to the level that we need, there's a lot more fear and ignorance about what that means. And so you can see it playing out in politics and all sorts of places now that our diversity is either embraced by some people or is, it causes an intense amount of fear with other people. So, but like my passion is having truly diverse integrated schools. If we could do that really well and then have a thoughtful plan about how kids could learn to interact in those schools, that would be the best strategy, long-term strategy for our country, you know, to move us forward in a way that people could really understand each other. But that's not happening in public education. That's actually, public schools are actually becoming more segregated over the last 20 years. And so we're actually going backwards from that. And I'm really fearful that that's going to actually continue to drive people apart. And it's such a central fabric of our democracy that it's a really worrisome trend. So, but back to your original question, like how do we do it? We do it by targeted marketing, essentially. So we actually just purposely go out and try to recruit a diverse application pool because people have to apply to come to Valor. So so we'll do like wine and cheese parties. That seems to work well for the middle income parents. They want to like have you to their house and invite their friends, and you talk about the school. And for some of our Black families, going to their churches is really effective, and getting their pastors on board is a really effective way. That's similar with some of our Hispanic families. Some of our really low-income families, door knocking is the most effective. So you got to get to their door, knock on their door, and just tell them about the school. So there's just, we found lots of different ways that are effective for different groups, and we'll do lots of those, and then we just measure our data after they fill in their applications about every 2 weeks, and we'll look and see like we're low in one demographic or another, and so we'll do more of that type of marketing that we think will attract more families from a group that we want to have, so that we get a really balanced group. And what we consider balanced is 50% free and reduced lunch, or 50% lower income and 50% middle or upper income. And then we want to have, ideally would love to have like the demographic mix of Southeast Nashville, which is about 20% Hispanic, 20% Black, 20% Kurdish, and 40% white.
That's kind of what the halls seem to look like when I come visit.
That's almost exactly where we are. So we're almost right in those numbers, within give or take a couple percentage points. That's where we are.
It's pretty amazing. So,
yeah, it's really amazing. And I love walking the halls and being in classrooms. And we have these prides, which is kind of like an advisory, but we make those purposely heterogeneous. So we try to have each pride match the kind of racial and socioeconomic mix of the school. So when a child's in their pride and they have 20 boys or girls in their pride and they look around, there's no racial majority in any of those. And about half the kids come from lower income backgrounds and half come from middle or upper income. And it's if you then do something powerful with that, which is what we also try to do, that can be a really transformational and powerful experience for kids.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds like a lot of work.
Yeah.
To be able to, I mean, it's a lot of intentionality and thoughtfulness to creating those situations. And I mean, that's commendable. And then my daughter always talks about the compass, and that's the thing that you guys work on. And I know she's always saying these things, that the way she's processing information and the way she's listening to people and thinking about what they say and then responding, she's clearly thinking about, it's not just what she's thinking about, but how she's thinking is not anything that I saw, that I knew when I was in middle school or now. It seems to really be effective, and I'd love to hear what that is. And is that kind of what your brotherhood started, that you've integrated?
Yeah, so...
that was rambly. I'll cut most of that.
No, that's awesome, and I love that she's... That you noticed.
It's true. You'll see her go... I hear what you say, and my initial response is this, but I think that maybe what, and it's like, who thinks like that when they're 12?
Yeah.
I don't think like that when I'm almost 40. I wish I did.
Yeah, it's
unbelievable.
It really is, and that kind of goes back to that story with Darren when I was in California and watched these high school kids talk like that, even though they'd grown up in situations where you'd think they should probably, that would be very challenging to have ever learned how to talk like that. And so that was the genesis of that idea. But we did spend many years leading up to even moving here, developing what's now called Compass, which is really a, in the education world, they call it social emotional learning, but we have always called it just like human development. It's really just like, how do you develop into a good human being in general? Yeah. And so in a lot of ways, it kind of moves into the spirituality or the character education. There's lots of different ways that you can kind of think about this, but it's really about, we went back to a body, mind, heart, spirit model that says like, those are the places that human beings over the course of history have tried to develop. And schools often have just been focused on the mind part, which makes sense, you know, but not always. Like over 2,000 years, if you go back to the Greeks and others, like it was a more holistic idea of like, how do you develop as a human being? But in modern U.S. education, it's much more about developing your mind. So we wanted to have an approach that was broader than that and to think through like, what does it mean to develop in a broader, more things that will help kids be successful in their lives? And so we have five dimensions of the compass, and sharp mind is one, which is the more traditional school thing, you know, like developing their sharp mind. And then big heart is the second one, developing your emotional side. And then noble purpose is really the spirit side, but it's really helping them develop their identity and understand their deepest values to kind of know who they are. And then aligned actions is the one that is more the body side, or just having the discipline and the persistence to live out your noble purpose every day. And then we added a fifth one in, which is from my first story about True North, is that we call it True North. I'm like, we have to get it in there somewhere. But True North is really about balance. So it's a little bit of finding that meditative space or a quiet space. So for a lot of our Christian families, it's like a contemplative space. And so for some of our Muslim families, they have different ways of viewing it. But for us, it's like, where do you find quiet space in your life to learn how to balance your head and your heart and draw on your deepest values to live a life of aligned actions? So that's kind of the nutshell of what we do with that. And then how we develop that is that it's pretty basic in fifth grade. You know, it's not for, I mean, we do get a lot of feedback that fifth graders do have much more advanced thinking and talking about this than a typical fifth grader, but it's still fifth grade type of stuff. You know, they're still reading Diary of a Wimpy Kid and other stuff. But then it's, you know, like our vision is it'll develop all the way through 12th grade, where it's actually pretty deep and meaningful stuff that our hope will be that they're going to be ready at a much deeper level than a typical kid would be when they leave high school to navigate the world in ways that are beyond just acing their AP exams and going to a good college. Because a lot of those kids aren't necessarily happy, and they aren't necessarily equipped to live inspired and purposeful lives. They might be equipped to, you know, to do well academically, but that's, in our opinion, isn't enough.
I love that. It's really cool. So how often do you think about those kids that you saw in India out of that bus window?
Yeah.
Do you think about that much?
I do, actually. I think about that trip a lot because it was really, it was just an important trip to me. And it was really, yeah, because it fundamentally changed my life, and it brought meditation into my life, because that was something I started to do regularly after that trip. And it brought like my sense and my understanding of spirituality into my life, which is something that I think of mostly in Christian terms, because that's how I grew up, you know, so that's actually just the most comforting version of it. But it became a much more central part of my life. And then I found what I find, you know, is my noble purpose in terms of doing the work that I do. So it was just such a important transformational trip for me. And it was really kind of that and the year kind of before and after that, but that like that moment in my life has really changed and pivoted from what I was doing before into something I'm just much more aligned and feel much more passionate about.
That's cool. Yeah. I love that you actually speak in the terms that you teach. That's pretty
yeah,
cool.
Yeah.
I like that. Yeah. Well, man, thank you so much for your time.
It's a real pleasure. No, it's been great. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
And we love having the family here too. So
thank you. See? Fascinating. Told you. Todd, thanks for your time. If you're interested in what Valor and Todd are building here in Nashville, you can check that out at valorcollegiate.org. They've got tons of great content, tons of great information. I think you'll find it really fascinating. It's a really cool place. Thank you guys again for listening to The Pivot. It's so fun getting to do this. We've got a lot of great interviews already recorded for the next couple months, and I'm so excited to get these out to you. So thank you for listening. Thanks for the reviews on iTunes. That's super helpful. Stay tuned after this little blurb here to hear me talk about another new song on The Painted Desert, the new record. Thanks so much for your support of that. Finally, if you want to find out more about this podcast, everybodypivots.com. And yes, that's it. You guys are the best. Now go do something awesome. Welcome to The Painted Desert. This is where I tell you a story about a song on a record that you can support on Kickstarter. Yes, again, this is marketing. Today, I'm going to talk about a song called Marjorie. It's the fourth track on the record. So there are a lot of these little song snippets that songwriters carry with them. Just sort of, here's a little line. I don't know what it means. It could go to anything. And over time, you sort of amass this just giant bag that you sort of carry with you of random lines, random melodies, random characters, random thoughts. And you sort of will plug them into different scenarios and different songs as you're working on them to see if they can ever find a home because something about it you really like. And I had, I had this little piece of a song that went, Marjorie sits by the shore of the lake unaware. That's just all it was, and I don't know where it came from. As I was writing these songs for this record, it felt like this song could fit. And so I had what is the first verse that you hear on the record, and then this other chorus that got like super spiritual and also didn't make a whole lot of sense. And I thought, yeah, that's cool. And the song was going to be like 45 seconds long because I really like songs that are really, really short. So after I had about 8 or 9 songs written, I invited some of my good friends who are also just world-class songwriters over to actually the little writing cabin next to Andrew Peterson's house. I wanted to play them these songs and get their feedback because there's always something you miss when you are the writer and the artist and the producer. They're just blind spots. And so I wanted to play the songs and hear what they thought and get their feedback. And like always happens, they would say, yeah, that's really cool. Now, what if you did this? What if you did that? And I had a reason why I shouldn't do that. And every time I was wrong, and I've made the changes that they suggested in, I think, every case, maybe but one. And so I played them this song, Marjorie, the verse and weird little chorus. And then they were like, what else? It's like, that's it. That's the song. Aren't I so cool? And they're like, no, that's horrible. You just got me interested in this character. And what happens? Where does it go? And why is that chorus there? And I had no answer. And that's when I realized that I had not finished writing the song. I had barely even started writing the song. So I went back to the drawing board and fleshed out a bit more of who she was. And the idea here was not necessarily to tell a big story about this person, but to tell the story of what it feels like when all of a sudden things change and we just have to go, well, what now? I've been in that situation from job things, health things, relationship things, financial things, whatever, and we all have. And so we know that feeling of, well, now what? I thought, man, wouldn't it be fun if we don't ever find out what's in the letter and what changed for her, but we just get to sit with her and go, yeah, now what? And that's what the song is about. And I just couldn't be happier with the way it turned out. And in fact, one of those friends who sat with me and gave me feedback on these songs, Randall Goodgame, sings the harmony and the verses and the chorus, which is really, really cool. And my oldest daughter, Ella, who is 12 right now, going on 13, she's saying all the ooh parts in the chorus, which is so pretty. It makes me kind of tear up every time I hear it. So I'm really happy with this song, and I believe good things are coming for her and for you. And this is a song called Marjorie.
Marjorie sits by the shore of the lake, unaware as the sun fades to west. Holding holding a letter she's read 7 times, but could not comprehend what it says. Oh, it's spun out of control, and everybody knows what you're just finding out. Please, what else could they need? You've given everything, it never was enough. Oh, Marjorie. Days come, and they will come.